production includes discussions about topics such as sexual assault, domestic violence, stalking, emotional violence, and physical violence. This content may be difficult, so should you continue to listen, I encourage you to care for your safety and well-being.
Welcome back. Hey guys, I am Leslie Jingleski with Avalon Center, and I'm honored today to be here with Janice Lucas. And so excited to have you here. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, allowing me to share my story.
The honor is all on our side of the table. It's a very brave thing for people to come and share their story, but I think it's beneficial to somebody who might be going through the same things and to hear. So I want to dive right in, and I want to talk to you. We talked about this story. This series is Why She Didn't Leave. And I think your story, although I don't know all the pieces of it, I saved it for the podcast. I want to know your story from the beginning, Dana. So take us back to the beginning and tell me how this all started.
So I was a baby. I was 18 years old. I had left home. I was pregnant. And my landlady introduced me to this guy who was the super, supposedly, of the building. If I needed anything, he was the one to go to. Fast forward maybe a week or so, I've given birth, but my daughter is a preemie, so I'm spending all day with her in the NICU, and then it's somewhere in the middle of the night, I go home to shower and, you know, refresh and eat. So after a few days, he noticed that I was coming in and out rather late, and he asked if I, you know, what I was out doing that time of night. I was too young to be, you know, kind of out in the streets. And I said, well, this is my situation. He said, oh, well, I come home that time of night anyway. Here's my pager number. Go ahead and let me know when you're on your way home and I can come and pick you up. And I'm like, I'm 18. I have like $0. Okay, great. That'll be fine. And so he ended up picking me up for a couple of days. And maybe about 3 or 4 days in, he started cooking. And I'm a big foodie. I love food. He didn't know that at the time. But I would come back to, you know, our building, and he would have like a 4-course meal waiting for me. And I would just go in, and I was starving, of course, and I would eat, and then I would go down to my apartment. And in the midst of, you know, these meetings, these you know, meetings we would have, so the car ride home, you know, talking in his apartment over food and what have you, you know, we just started getting to know each other a little bit. He already had kids, you know, I knew he had been married before, and I felt like he was just sharing his heart with me. I felt like he was opening up, and he was being so intimate and telling me all these detailed things about his life. So when my daughter finally came home from the hospital, I kind of knocked on his door as I went down to my apartment because we stayed on the same floor, and not 5 minutes later, he was banging on my door. He wanted to meet my baby, and, you know, after a while, I just truly felt like he fell in love with her. He was great with her. He was great with his kids. And in my mind, I'm like, okay, this is family. This is what family is.
Who wouldn't think that?
Exactly. Like, he's sweet. Yeah. He's looking out for me. He's loving on my daughter. And I don't have to worry about anything funny going on. And that was, you know, soon after, you know, we became a couple. And, you know, we started doing a couple things and, you know, visits with the kids and all this stuff. And pretty much anything that he wanted, I'm just like, okay, that's not a big deal to me. I've always been a go with the flow kind of girl. And so when it was, well, I don't want to be around family because I want us to do something together. And I'm like, oh yeah, great. We can spend our time together. Everything in my rose colored glasses was so perfect. It was.
He was pulling those strings.
Exactly.
Things that you needed at that time in your life.
Yeah. Yeah. And there was no way for me to see it in this headspace that I was in. My family didn't approve. My friends, you know, there were issues. And it became more of an issue outside of the house eventually than just in the house. And so it affected more than just me and my daughter. And then we had a daughter together. So now I feel like I can't leave. This is her dad. I didn't know my dad. I grew up without a father figure. So if I leave, what happens to my daughters? Will they no longer have a father in their life? It's not that bad. It's just a few behaviors. It's just a few words. I can deal with this. At least they have someone in their life.
And, so, and because you love him, you've fallen in love with him. I think people discount love, right? That's a big piece.
It's huge, because love is why you stay. Love is why you make confession, and love is why you, you know, make, I forget the word I was trying to use, but the love is why you do what you do, and you come from
it's a driving force. Absolutely. We love our children, right? So we love our children. And when they mess up, we don't love them any less. That's the piece that I think a lot of people miss.
Yeah, exactly. And so when you, you know, you love someone, you want the best for them. And then your kids are our kids. This is our family. And I love my family. Mm-hmm. So of course I want to do everything in my power to keep my family together. And it doesn't really matter how I'm affected. I just want to make sure my family's okay. And I think that is something that is worldwide. I think that's women. I think that's men. I think that's not abusive relationships. I think that's healthy relationships. You do what you feel like you need to do to keep the family together. But in something that's not healthy, you're wanting it and you're doing more than the other person is. And you don't really see it in the moment. You see it later on. Right. So our relationship shifted slowly. It became very verbally abusive, psychologically abusive, physically abusive. I was not allowed to be around my friends or my family. He drove them away on purpose. If I didn't answer my text or my cell phone, he would call every single person that I said that I was with and blow up their phones until I responded. So then my friends didn't want to be around me anymore. My family, of course, they loved me, but it was becoming more of an issue than a non-issue.
This is probably a gradual thing, right?
It was gradual. Our first daughter came 2 years after we met.
Right. And is he your age? Older? Younger? Same?
18 years older.
18 years?
16.
Okay. So 16 years older. So, and you're still at this point a baby. Right?
Yeah.
Because funny. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I can imagine that this guy has life experience, and you teeter between compromise, because marriage is compromise. Anybody who tells you otherwise is not telling you the whole truth. Correct. Compromise is a very dangerous rope to walk, because it's very careful. So I imagine, you know, and you do hear that all the time. With a family. Family's hard. Family, you need to be careful. So all of these pieces up until it got, when do you think the light went on in your mind that,
this is it? So there was a day when my oldest daughter was maybe 3. And my youngest daughter was 1 at the time. And by now we were living together, and our arguments and our fights became so eruptive. And I remember I couldn't find my girls. And so I went upstairs and I found them in the corner of the closet with the door closed. My oldest daughter had her little sister in her lap and she was like wrapping her in her arms. And when I opened the closet door and found them in the corner, I said, baby, what's wrong? And she said, and she just shook her head, didn't even say anything. That was the light for me, like, this is not okay.
And they were responding from an argument that you two were having, which had become normal for you.
It was normal for me. I didn't know, you know, how to separate what we were doing as a couple and what they were seeing, because I was young. I didn't know to separate the two.
Wow. So fast forward, and this all, I'm sure you understand the power and control wheel and how things start. And you, at this point, you've been isolated from your family. You've been isolated from your friends. It took 3 years. It sounds like from the time that your baby was born, when he started courting you, to now. And that's a long time. That's a long time to build a relationship. And it's not just, you know, 2 weeks into the relationship, we're together, and he decides, you've established a history here. You've established a family. And so it's very gradual. We talked about that. And you still had your family, I'm sure, to look back on. When did it get violent?
It started getting violent. A little after I had our daughter, so a little after 2 years, the emotional and the verbal started not maybe 6 months to 8 months in. You know, I didn't know. I was young and just listened to whatever because I thought this is what this is supposed to be like. But the physical violence started after my second daughter was born. There were times where I would try to leave because I didn't want to be confrontational in front of the children. And he would literally, I'm 5 foot even if you look tall, but I'm 5 foot. About 5'10", 5'11". Back then I was like 115 soaking wet. And he was, you know, almost 200 pounds, a little over 200. And literally would pick me up and just let me go to drop me on the concrete outside. Just different things is how it started until it became physically like punching. And, you know, I had a knife against my throat one time because I answered his phone. I wasn't supposed to. So it was gradual. It definitely didn't happen all at once because those are red flags, immediate red flags. But when you talk to a certain amount of time and you're being told that you're not worth anything, you start to believe what you're told. So your self-esteem is already low. You're not connected to your support system or your community. And so it's easy to kind of just drift into this space of just whatever they say goes, and however they treat me, I must have deserved it because they said I deserved it.
Right. When you, and I was talking to someone the other day about another survivor, and she called them love bombs. She said, you know, after an event or after something, she said, you know, in the heat of the moment, it would be easy for me to leave, but then there would be these love bombs and the apology, and I'm so sorry, it's never going to happen. Did you experience that?
I didn't get the love bombs. It was more like, it was just more psychological. Like, for instance, I was pregnant with number 4 because we ended up having 3 children together. And one of the women that he was cheating with and was flirting with came to church one day as a visitor, and she saw him and she saw us, and she told her friend, "This is the guy who's been leaving me all these messages." And she played the messages for her friend. And then we ended up having this meeting, and it was just all this stuff. Well, on the way home, he was like, "Well, that's what you deserve. That's what you get. You wanted to know the truth." I didn't ask for any of this. You know what I mean? So it wasn't love bombs for me. It was more, this is what happens when you want to know the truth. This is what happens when you ask questions. This is what happens when you don't do what I tell you to do. So for me, it wasn't the love bombs. It was watching what had me stay at that point, again, was just mentally being completely in a wrong headspace, believing everything that he said, believing I was everything that he said, but then watching the kids. For them, they were my main and biggest focus. I hear so many people say that they stay in relationships because of their children. And I totally understand what that is. But then I tell them, don't do it for the kids, because the kids know there's something wrong. Even if you verbalize, because after that incident with the girls, I never allowed the kids to see anything ever after that point. But they always know something's wrong.
What was the event that happened that you said,
So 15 years later, because we stayed together for 15 years, and I was ironing his clothes the night before for work. And I'm a woman of faith. I'm a believer. I love the Lord. And I just remember looking up, and I was just like, God, there's got to be another way. This cannot be what you have for me. And the next day, my oldest daughter was the only one who had a cell phone at the time. And she called me from one of her friend's phones, and she said, "Mom, my phone is off." I said, "Okay, don't worry about it. I'll look into it." I knew that I gave him money to pay the bill. So when she called me, I just went on his laptop to look up the account. At the time, AT&T had profiles, and you could put your picture on the profile. Well, I saw his profile, and it had his picture, which I thought was weird, but mine and my daughter's didn't have a picture. So I was like, you know what? And I get sidetracked very easily. So I said, you know what? Let me just look and see if there's other pictures. I'll add one of the pictures of the kids onto our profiles. When I went to into his pictures, I saw pictures of half-naked women and a lot of other things. And I was just like, God, I thank you. That's it for me. Like, that's it. And so a few days later, I told him that I wanted a divorce. And he literally lunged. I remember I was in the kitchen. I'm sorry, in my bathroom. And I was in front of the bathtub. And he lunged at me and he said, over my dead body. Now, he hadn't been physically anything for years. But when he did that, it automatically took me back to all those times that he had been physical with me. And so after that, like, he would try to say little things when the children were around, but I didn't know they were around, to make me say the word divorce, or make me say you need to leave, or make me say whatever in front of them. And so at that was the thing that said, no, enough is enough. I did have a slight of a nervous breakdown after that. I was at work training this young poor kid. I still feel bad for him. And I just started to cry out of nowhere. I had to excuse myself to the bathroom, and I literally cried for hours, could not stop. I thank God that I was working for law enforcement at the time, and they had their advocates come and speak with me and took me straight to the local police department. I filed for my restraining order. They helped me pick up my kids from school, and restraining order is what got him out of the house that night.
That's fantastic. When he lunged at you, were there ever times that the police had come for domestic disputes before?
I had restraining orders on him when we still lived in New York, because we're originally from New York. I had restraining orders on him then, multiple police reports. After living in Florida and after everything had shifted and changed, I'm thinking, okay, maybe he's not that guy, but I still knew he was that guy. And right. So when wanted to get his records sealed, and I had to give permission. Of course, I'm the wife. I'm not supposed to allow my husband to look bad. So I gave.
Outside looking in, if I were to meet you guys as a couple, how would I describe him?
The nicest, sweetest, kindest person. He's funny. He's relatable. He loves his family. He's an excellent father. No one on the outside looking in ever knew that there were issues unless they really saw them.
Yeah, so that makes it easy for me as an outsider to say, oh, he would never do that. I know this guy.
Yeah. I have people now to this day who, because we had so much that happened even after our divorce, mm-hmm. who literally will tell me, Janice, I don't know why you keep saying this about him. That's not who he is. Okay. And I just let them live with their belief. I know the truth, and I'm okay with it. You don't want to believe it, that's okay.
That's a great sign of growth, personally. But I feel like that is so important for people, because when I talk to survivors who have gone through this, that is a constant. That is the one constant thing where it's, I think people have this driven thing in their mind where it's for the poverty stricken. Right. They have this thing in their mind where it's for the uneducated, and that's not the case. Domestic violence knows from the outside looking in, I would say, and I don't have facts to back this up, I would say 9 out of 10 people have no idea what's going on behind those closed doors.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's one of the things that I always say. My kids were really never allowed to leave my house. Their friends had to come to my house. And even now, my 16-year-old will be like, well, Mom, I can, you know, go to so-and-so. I said, listen, I don't know what happens behind those closed doors. There's no way you can go.
Yeah, it is a very sad truth. I think people have this driven thing in their mind where it's for the poverty-stricken, right? They have this thing in their mind where it's for the uneducated, and that's not the case.
Telling me any kind of a compliment was never heard in my house. They never heard him say, "You're pretty, you're nice, I like the way you dress." It was always a put down, a let down. And even to this day, even though we're not, you know, we've been divorced 10 years now, but even to this day, my children, and I believe it's because they didn't hear it, so it's just not in their natural conscious to say it, do not compliment me on a regular basis. We're very close. I know that they love me. I know that they always have my best, you know, interest at heart. But just on regular, "Oh, Mom, you look nice today." And I don't fault them for that because that was the environment that they grew up in.
Because it's generational, right? Mm-hmm. I would bet my left leg, not knowing your abuser, that he did not grow up in a healthy household. And so when we talk about moving forward and prevention efforts, prevention effort, we can respond, and Avalon does in our area, and I'm sure there's agencies in your area that respond to help survivors get on their feet, safety planning, and doing all these things. But until we can teach our children from a very young age, and when I say young age, I mean toddlers before they're speaking, what a healthy relationship is, the cycle will continue. And it's not an excuse for an abuser. It's not, but it is subconscious for them. And I've heard abusers say, "I will never be like my father," but it happens, right? It comes out. It comes out with sometimes with apology, sometimes without. And your situation, unfortunately, is without apology. So, and you have been free of your abuser for 10 years. Is that what you said?
Yeah. Well, kind of. We had that happened afterwards. He actually set me up for murder. So we had a whole situation. Yeah, he planned it. He organized it. State attorney said he had everything to do with it. I was shot in my home twice. So recovery was definitely interesting. It was very difficult, but I'm grateful to have come over on the other side of it. But he was never formally charged with anything, even though they knew that he had everything to do with it.
When was this?
This was in 2012.
And how, and this was, you were in your home.
I was in my.
And you guys were already separated.
Already divorced.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
And he, yeah. Oh my gosh.
Kids. And so, you know, despite everything, I still had to, you know, timeshare. And I would never keep the kids from their dad anyway. But when my kids would go, they were not allowed to take their keys. And my son forgot one time. And when he came home, he's like, "Mom, I'm so sorry, but I forgot my key. I left it at dad's and I couldn't find it." I was like, "Don't worry about it. I'm not upset. Just remember, you know, don't take it back." So the next few times he went to get the key, he couldn't find it. And then all of a sudden it popped up on his dresser like it had been there the whole time. So the idea
is that... How old was your son at this time?
He's 21 now, and this is 2012, so 9.
So, oh, wow. Was this at night when this happened?
It was about 10:30 at night when I got home from church on a Sunday. I had just taken the kids there earlier that day. So, you know, he knew that my children weren't going to be home. And he had a lady come to my house, break in. She shot me. She shot my ex at the time. And, yeah, she just left me for dead. But it was all planned. They had record and proof that they had been, my ex and her had been communicating for years. And they had a lot of records. They had a lot of proof that he was involved. It just wasn't concrete enough to file any charges.
Oh my gosh. So, and that was the last violent, was that the last violent incident? Aside from, you still have to co-parent.
Co-parent, and I have a granddaughter. So birthdays, we just had her birthday a couple weeks ago at an Airbnb, and you know, him and his fiance and their new person were there. And it's a lot. It's really a lot. But I definitely have some PTSD, not going to lie about it. And everything working cohesively still for me is key and the main thing. My granddaughter loves her papa. I can't say that I, because he's going to be at her birthday, that I won't be there.
Right. And so it just goes to show you that once that power and control is established, now he uses the children to hold that power over you. It doesn't end, but I think that's important for survivors to know that it is possible to get through it, but
I don't know that I would, and this could just be the non-survivor side of me, but I don't know necessarily that he's using that over the granddaughter, because I don't have to be there. Mm-hmm. I could say, let's celebrate on a different day. So that could be the non-survivor part of me to make it easy on my children. Mm-hmm. Let's all together, don't worry, it's going to be fine. Let's not spend extra finances, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, obviously we could definitely do that on a different day, and I'm fine with it. Like my children's birthdays, we never celebrate together. It's always separate.
And what is your children's relationship with their father?
So it was never great. We had family meetings where my kids were allowed to vocalize anything that was bothering them without repercussion, as long as they didn't cuss. And it was always his, how he spoke with them, how he treated them, how he interacted with them. He was never supportive. It was always mom on duty. If we were in the house, he was in the kitchen. Kids weren't allowed in the kitchen. If he was in his room, kids weren't allowed to be in there with him, but yet he wasn't with us in the family room or when, you know, people came over. So it was always a separation, and it was always a relationship that the kids longed for. So now they speak with him, but like my 16-year-old doesn't talk to him on a regular. My 21-year-old, they're casual. And my daughter, she wants to be daddy's little girl. And you know, it's sad, but you know, now that she has my granddaughter, their communication has been more consistent, but it's basically because of the baby.
Right. I have the word that I'm looking for right now, but your story is inspirational, that you are where you are.
Thank you. I just believe that my ability to pull strength from literally every facet of my being has a lot to do with my kids. I mean, they are my driving force every day that I'm alive. I have to be okay for them. I have to mentally and physically be okay for them, because they need me at the end of the day. Now that everybody's kind of grown and out the house, and you know, my youngest is working and he's barely home, like, I'm figuring out life for me again. Like, who am I as a person? And it's kind of like a combination of the recovery plus almost like an empty nester situation where I'm learning me. So I'm finally at a point where I can just be content with who I am. I'm a very transparent person, and I've told my story enough to where it doesn't brutally affect me like it used to. And I think that that has helped with my healing. The more that you talk about it, the more that you heal from it, as far as I'm concerned. I've done counseling, I've done life coaching, I've done a lot of different things to help me get to a place where I'm my own person again.
And I think it's okay for a survivor to be in a situation, and I'm sure that you dealt with this, and maybe you didn't, because your story, every story is different, but the shame involved and okay. Why, you know, you almost enable the situation because you contribute to the facade that our family is perfect.
Oh yeah.
I understand that. I understand it completely. And we talk about, you know, well, you don't want to air your dirty laundry. Sometimes it's okay. Sometimes it is okay. Did you have friends looking back at the situation that maybe you would, and consciously or subconsciously, feel, test the waters to look to see if there's any validation behind? I know a lot of survivors will kind of drop a little hint here to a friend, because I have a lot of people reach out that say, what do I do as a friend? And our response is validate their feelings. if they drop just a little bit of a hint, never ever say, well, you know, that's marriage, or, well, you know, validate that their gut, their inner gut is telling them something that they need to listen to.
Absolutely. Listening and having a listening ear is key. Just hear them out, hear where their heart is, hear where they're coming from. Not from your perspective of what you see, because, you know, everyone knows that there's things that go on behind closed doors that not everybody is privy to. So is it possible that maybe just a smidget of what your friend is telling you is valid? Is it possible that half a percent of her emotions are real and are valid? Just hear her out. Just hear her out and try to take out everything that you know. Try to take out everything that you've seen, or maybe not. Pay attention to those things that you've seen even the closer. Like, maybe when this was happening, this is really what was happening, and I just thought they were playing around. Just, you know, look at it from a different perspective, but absolutely hear them out. Hear them out with a kind listening ear.
It is so important. And establish that safe zone. You know, we talk about these issues. Establish that safe zone that she can call you at any time and say, you know, I'm having a bad day. And I think, and I think probably you will agree, you don't need to be told what to do.
Absolutely not.
It is leaving one situation. And we have a hard time with this. That's part of our being trauma-informed, is you don't want a survivor to leave one power situation to another. So the, you know, you oughta, that is not okay. It's really not. And you know, leaving and having the courage to leave can actually be life-threatening.
Absolutely.
Yep. So we can't just say, well, you need to leave. It's really easy to sit back and say, just leave, leave. But there are children involved. There's love involved. There is a life involved that walking away from, and many times going to a communal shelter, leaving a home and going to a communal shelter is not, it's not the ideal situation. It's just not.
And honestly, there's a lot of pride in not walking away. There's pride in what will other people think of me. There's pride in I'm beyond this. Why should I have to go to a shelter? There's so much pride that's involved, and you don't even really see it in the moment. But you have those thoughts. And in all honesty, they're prideful thoughts. And the last thing that anybody wants to hear is what you should do. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, everybody knows what we should do. But we're not ready. We're not ready to hear it. We're not ready to listen. And no matter how many times my family told me, Janice, he is just not, da 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 da. Yeah. Okay. I had to be ready on my own.
I feel like that attitude creates even more of a divide. Because now I don't want to talk to you. Now I want to cover this up more. And so it's not helpful. It's actually enabling the situation. Yeah. So, and many women leave. It takes 7 times. It takes a woman 7 times to leave for good on average. Maybe they leave once and they call you back and you say, you know what? If you need to go back home, that's okay. I'm here when you're ready to leave again. Yeah. I'm here to help you safety plan. I have agencies like Avalon. And so when you were going through everything, did you ever get counseling while you were still with your abuser?
Oh yeah, we went to counseling regular. It was, you know, very. He was the typical king of narcissism. So the counselors were always like, "Oh, really?" Like, he had everyone wrapped around his little finger. Nothing that I said either made sense, or it just. I always felt like no one's listening, no one's hearing me. And I felt like I couldn't get my words right. I couldn't get them out in the right way to get someone to listen, because they always seemed to listen to him. Everything that he said was golden. But yeah, we went to counseling multiple times. And I did. I tried to leave two times, I think, prior. The right. One time when I just had the two girls. And then and another time, I literally left with my daughters again, moved to St. Louis, shaved off all my hair.
Wow.
I know a lot of doing it now, but back then it wasn't as popular. I just a fresh start. I wanted something new. And, you know, he somehow got a hold of my aunt that I was living with and, you know, in her ear. And, but Janice, you know, he really loves you. He really, so of course I'm like, well, maybe they have a point. Maybe it wasn't as bad as I thought. Maybe this, maybe that. He drove to St. Louis and picked us up and brought us home.
Your story is so much like others out there. What would you say to a survivor right now who may be listening to this and saying, gosh, I'm her. This is my situation. What would you say to her or tell yourself? Go rewind 15, 20 years. What would you tell yourself?
15, 20 years ago, me, I would tell her, you know you. You know this isn't okay. Regardless of what anybody says, you hear that quiet voice inside of you that is telling you this is not okay. Make a change. Make a plan. Talk to someone. Listen. If it doesn't matter if they're in your house. It doesn't matter if they're at church. It doesn't matter. You don't have to know them. But go to someone who will listen and who will hear you out and tell the truth. No more covering up lies. No more pretending that everything is okay. Break down. Cry. Tell your truth and be honest.
Because it's okay. It's okay not to know what to do.
It is.
And I think that's the big thing, because we do, as women, we fight this battle. I can do this on my own. I am strong. I am powerful. I can do this. But part of that is knowing when you need help.
Exactly.
And being able to, but you got to find that person. You got to find that person who is an equal and who can sit down and just listen and meet you where you are. And, you know, I'm not ready to leave. This is dangerous for me emotionally. This is dangerous. This could be physically dangerous. So I'm not ready to leave. But I, of course, encourage people to get a hold of your local agency, because a lot of times, and post-COVID especially, there a lot of times now you don't need to drive to a counselor's office. They can do it right there from your phone. Mm-hmm. They can talk to you. A good counselor is not going to tell you what you need to do. A good counselor is going to say, these are the pieces that I have for you. What is your goal today? Do we need a safety plan? Do we need to maybe get a hold of your bank statements, put them, you know, do these things that will allow you to stay safe in your home and your situation until such time you, and I think those are just important pieces. And gosh, your story is, it's Janice, look at you. You look what all that you've overcome. And I think you will be an inspiration, or are, not will be, you are an inspiration to so many people out there, and for your children especially, because they see it. They know.
They're awesome people.
So Janice, as we move through for the healing part of this, you did something amazing. Tell me about
it. So I wrote a book about my entire experience. And it has A to Z in it. Even though I know my story is far from over. But this part of my life, I've actually wrote it down and put it into print. So I'm super excited about it. The title is How Did I Get Here? A Story of God's Grace. Because I believe that at some point, any person who is in a domestic a domestic abuse relationship always has that question, how did I get here? How did I let it get this far? And so this is my account. It is true. It is my autobiography of how I got to the point that I got to before we met, how everything transpired and how it went during the relationship, and how it ended and everything that happened after that.
Just, I cannot wait to read your book. And we'll obviously keep our people informed of when you got it. You said, when are you looking at a release? Do you know?
So October 13th is going to be the official book launch. My oldest daughter passed away a few years ago, and that is her birthday. So we're going to launch on her birthday.
Oh, God. Like you said, your story's not over, but this is the part that you want to share. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Avalon Center's podcast, Responding with Hope, is paid for by the Department of Social Services. Avalon Center offers emergency shelter, individual and group counseling, and much more to survivors of domestic and sexual assault. If you need help, call our 24-hour hotline at 833-537-0970 or visit us at avaloncenter.org.